Good evening, and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Kira Reginato, filling in for John Milford, chair of the club's Grown-Ups Forum, and I'm your host for today. We welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, and I'm very excited to hear this presentation. As I mentioned, I'm an elder care manager, and everybody I talked to said, how are we going to get older? I'm 51, and I already live in community, and drove somebody who lives in the house to the bar last night, so he didn't have to drive there. He could take a cab home. When my car doesn't work, somebody drives me to get it fixed. We already are using each other in an informal way, so I'm really excited to hear what author and speaker Charles Durrett has to say tonight. So, Charles, take it away.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you for coming. My name is Charles Durrett, and I'm going to talk about something near and dear to my heart, the power of community. I grew up in a small town of 325 people, and their very first hand, day in and day out, found what it's like to live in a place where people cared about each other, knew each other, cared about each other, and supported each other. And then I also lived in Sacramento, California for half of my life, and it was quite a contrast where it was a regular suburban environment, and year after year I kept seeing the contrast between those environments and feeling like how odd and anonymous those environments were. Then my lovely wife convinced me to move to downtown San Francisco, where we lived at Alamo Square for a few years, and I was even struck further how hard it was to say hello to somebody walking down the sidewalk and how often they looked at their shoes. I started saying, nice shoes. Yeah, those are nice shoes. Those are really nice shoes. And of course, you know, people have their own reasons for, being anonymous. It's understandable at some level. Unless you know each other, you're not going to care for each other. And that's the thing that I love about living in a co-housing. I live in a 34-unit co-housing community in Nevada County now, up by Lake Tahoe. Before that, I lived in a 12-unit co-housing community in Emeryville, as close as we were able to create it in San Francisco. One of the residents are here, Fran. And at the time when we were living in San Francisco, I was motivated to create a co-housing community here. At the time, property was too expensive. I don't know if it's got cheaper or not. I don't think so. And there still, unfortunately, is not a co-housing community in San Francisco per se. However, I'm very familiar with the variety of co-ops and other means, and shared houses and all the rest that people have put together, and co-living is also growing as an option here. Many, many other options, and I'm actually looking forward to seeing a co-housing community happen in San Francisco at some time. Before I ratchet through these slides, I think I'll just describe, a few of the pathologies, that I personally, not only recognize but feel strongly that co-housing can address. Last year, Americans drove over 5 billion miles just to take Meals on Wheels and Nurses on the Go to seniors. That is not sustainable by any stretch of the imagination. According to the author Bill Thomas, we have a $3 trillion budget dilemma in this country, which means 20 years from now, if we try to take care of seniors in this country like we're taking care of them now, given the bubble of seniors moving forward, we would have about a $3 trillion increase in costs. In a total GDP of $13 trillion, $3 trillion is a chunk of change. It's not sustainable either. So, what is more likely to happen is that seniors will grow more isolated, and less cared for than they already are. And I don't mean just cared for physically and physiologically. What makes the huge difference to me is how well they can get along emotionally and socially. And nothing seems to make people feel safer than feeling like they're part of a community, and nothing makes them less safe than emotionally than feeling like they're completely isolated and cast adrift. And the average American senior is watching TV over 6 hours a day now. So, not only is that a vast waste of, you know, this elderhood and these people who could be contributing, not only eldering young people, but eldering each other. When I watch seniors in my own community, we have 20 seniors and 37 children, 57 adults altogether, 37 children, and 20 of those adults are seniors. But when I watch them elder each other, I see wisdom helping people grow older better, basically setting each other up for success. When I see people cast adrift and watching TV 6 hours a day, I see people, set up for failure. In fact, actually, there's a great book called Four Arguments Against TV. And one of the arguments, especially for seniors, is when this stuff goes into your head, which generates paranoia, for example, you can't get it out of your head. And so, you know, the dogs and lights and, you know, TV cameras outside your door and all, you know, higher fences, and those are that's the growth industry as we get older. And the growth industry should be a setting, a more village-like setting, that sets us up to knowing each other, caring for each other. And supporting each other. Just one small indication of that. I was, you know, we used to have an office in Berkeley, California. Our architecture office was there for 25 years. Or 20 years, and one night around midnight, an intern and I were in there working on a common house, which I'll elaborate further on here in a second, but we were working on a common house, and John's band, his band, he had a rock and roll band on the side besides being an architect, and his name of his band was The Poison Squirrels. So I asked him one day, I said, John, how did you ever come up with this name, The Poison Squirrels? And he says, well, you know, I started watching Mr. Rogers when I was 5, and it wasn't until I was 12 that I realized he wasn't saying, good morning, poison squirrels. And he said, you know, what's so ironic about that is that's what motivated me to come and work for you making co-housing, because these isolated kids should not have these misconceptions floating around in their brains for 7 years before, they get, paired up with other kids who can, you know, in a village-like setting that can help create context to, you know, this weird life that we try to navigate, and that's in spades for seniors in terms of, you know, the number of misconceptions that people get in their heads and rattle about, and they're just living, you know, in a weird, bad commercial. The other thing that Bill Thomas says that I think is fascinating, if you've never read his book, it's really a bestseller and it's a great book. It's called What Are Old People For Anyway? And one of the things he says in that book is that you take 20 seniors and you put them on a boat and you take them out to a desert island, they'll do a better job of caring for each other than any institution we have yet created. And we have a lot of people trying to create institutions. But it's certainly been my experience watching seniors live in co-housing. And I hope you get the same impression, or I'd be curious to hear your impression when I'm done. But where they have figured out how to manage their own lives better than anybody else, and their own caregiving, for example, than anyone else. It means hiring caregivers, don't get me wrong, but there's something about hiring caregivers before you're drooling, for example, when they know you as real people, they care about you, they've grown to care about you as a real person, and you were hired along with, you know, 20 other seniors played a role in your being hiring. And 20 other seniors are making sure that anybody who's caregiving anybody is doing a good job, for example. And by the way, when you have to move off to an institution, which happens, there's the old saying that the care you get in any senior institution is completely a function of the number of people outside the institution who care about you. And, you know, people just step up when they have to step up. That's just the reality. Okay, so let me show some slides. Can we dim the lights a little, por favor? Anyway, do we have the technology? I mean, if we get on the net, we can probably do it. Uh, Or outside this door here? Thank you. Anybody have a... I'll proceed, and maybe we'll figure out how to dim the lights a little bit. Co-housing is basically a custom neighborhood. And that's this whole point about you can get on a boat and go to a desert island and do a better job than any institution. You know, for those of you who believe that the government can solve everything, I think our government should step up infinitely more than it is, don't get me wrong. But I was watching these hearings from Scotland the other day, their parliamentary hearings. It's a weird habit I like to do. And this woman was getting up to testify in front of parliament about how, sure, they have great senior care, but she had 133 caregivers last year, sometimes two different caregivers on the same day. So emotionally and physiologically, that's extremely complicated, basically. So setting a more stable environment than, again, any institution can do, and certainly better than any, private setting can do. But I found nothing, huh? Okay, well, the squint. All right. I have personally as an architect, I'm constantly striving to find, more thoughtful environments, more appropriate environments for the dwellers. And I have found, even as an architect who has designed now over 50 co-housing communities, so often people say to me, hey, Chuck, you've designed 50 co-housing communities. Why don't you just design us up a little site plan? And there's several reasons. And one is that, people bring such real values and real thoughtfulness to the table that they just make a better site plan every single time. Working with the future residents, it's just a better site plan every time. So if I want to do the best site plan I possibly can, of course, it's very hands-on, extremely hands-on, not to mention the fact this happens to be in Maine, and this gentleman here up on the upper right, I guess these things don't work on these screens, but the gentleman on the upper right had 50 acres, 5 miles out of town, a dirt road, off the grid. He was very proud of it. But now he was thinking about moving to town in a co-housing. But you can imagine on 50 acres, and now we're talking about putting 34 houses on a couple of acres, it took a little bit of imagination on his part. And yet he came more and more to realize that as he got housing design is that you feel like you have as much privacy as you want, or you have as much community as you want. And that's kind of different than regular single-family house subdivisions, where you feel like you have as much privacy as you want, or as much privacy as you want. In other words, that's one of the reasons I've grown to feel that co-housing really resonates with Americans, because Americans seem to appreciate choice. And even this gentleman who was moving from 50 acres off the grid started to see that living alone and privacy was only 50% of the equation, and having a choice to walk out my front door and be with other people that I've known for a long time, like a small town, was another half of the equation that, in fact, contributed greatly to his own quality of life. Interestingly enough, we just did a 31-unit co-housing project in the middle of Vancouver. And it was very complicated and a very hard site. We would have never gotten that project approved. But the Vancouver Foundation had just published a report that described, in fact, how lonely people are in the city of Vancouver. I mean, it's quite a darling town now in the world. But the Vancouver report was quite an indictment on the social life in that town. In fact, 57% of the responders said that they did not trust their neighbor. And that number only went down to 40% after they had been living in that neighborhood for over 25 years. So, and that book, that 3/4 of an inch book really was a watershed for us. It's the first co-housing project in downtown Vancouver. We probably would have not gotten that project approved. It was a quite hallowed site in Vancouver. I mean, it'd be like trying to put a new project on Golden Gate Park. And but the whole city came together and said, no, we have to try this. This makes too much sense. This report is such an indictment on our social life, and we've got to figure out, you know, additional ways to make it possible and easy for people to connect. This is where I live now, 34 units, and that's the people diving in to, you know, move the blocks around and come to a neighborhood. And interestingly enough, you know, Nevada County, where I live, is quite rural. Lots of people were moving from 20 acres. Lots of people were moving from 100 acres. So I was actually quite worried about it. I had got all these country iconoclastic yahoos. You know, what's this going to be like, you know, getting together and making a neighborhood together? And so I asked everybody in a huge parking lot to separate 110 feet from each other, two people at a time. And I explained that, or I suggested that last night, Sunday night, common dinner in the common house, and you had a conversation with somebody at the table, that and she mentioned that she was going to have a very difficult conversation later that night with a grown child, you know, like a divorce or a breakup or even an abortion or something really complicated, now I want you to imagine that it's 8:30 on a Monday morning, and both of you are going to work at the same time, and both of you are opening your front door at the same time. And you don't want to pry necessarily, but you want to sort of be able to guess what kind of a mood this person is in, so that maybe later that day you might stop and say hello to her, you might call her or something, and touch in and see how she's doing. But the point is, you give a damn, you care. So now I want you people that are 110 feet from each other, 110 feet, because that's a typical American suburb, front door to front door. So I said, now I want you guys to walk towards each other until one of you stop. Then I want the other one to stop. And that's going to be the new front door to front door on this 11-acre site, you know, but that's going to be the front door to front door in this neighborhood. So the range was 26 feet to 40 feet. 26 feet is not far. It's less than from here to the back wall, from front door to front door. So that's the neighborhood that these guys felt that it was going to have to be that dense or denser in order to care about, you know, my neighbors, at least to, not to care, but to support them. I mean, it's one thing to care about somebody, but if you're out of sight, it's easy to be out of mind. You may or may not be able to do anything for anybody if you can't see them, you know, at 8:30 on a Monday morning necessarily. So anyway, and so even these guys who had grown, you know, used to an environment that was much spread out, but it was spread out because they didn't know each other. They didn't know each other, which means you don't care as much. In fact, you want to make sure that they're at arm's distance. And the same thing was true when we lived at 625 Scott Street in San Francisco. You know, what happened there when I'd wake up, you know, when I'd open my door at 8 o'clock to go to work, is if the person across the hall opened their door, well, we'd both close our door, sort of wait for the other one to, who was going to leave first. Because something, it's a whole other social dynamic when you don't know each other, basically. Once you do know somebody, then you, hey, what's going on? How you doing? What are you doing after work? Let's have a beer, et cetera. It's a whole other social dynamic, so... and the second reason that I care so much about making these projects with the future residents is not just because they make a better project, but they own it emotionally. They very, very much own it. And every single time we're really breaking the box. There's nothing regular about these necessarily. Nobody comes in and says, let's just do the default. They say, let's make something that fits like a glove. As soon as you try to make something that fits like a glove, that means it's not the default solution. It's not what the zoning code says. It's not what the building department says. It's like something that fits like a glove. And therefore, we have to sell it. So the powers that be, the banks, et cetera. We did the Emeryville co-housing. You know, we wanted to have glass doors on the front so that, you know, you could actually see people at your front door instead of not, and the bank wouldn't have anything to do with it. We thought for sure we were going to have to rent solid core doors until we were all financed and then put in our glass doors. But anyway, it was the future residents who sold the bank. No, this is what I really want. This is not more less secure. This is actually more secure. So you were actually flip-flopping lots of line items along the way. And you know, the established institutions are not, you know, require a little prodding. Well, frankly, there's nobody who does that prodding better than the future residents who help come up with it themselves. So there's, you know, basically four key elements to co-housing. One is that the future residents are very much party to the design, the development, the organization. Two is that there's extensive common facilities. Three is that it's self-managed entirely. And four is that it's actually designed to facilitate a sense of community over time. You know, basically, once the honeymoon has worn off from creating it, that the architecture lends towards, you know, easy relationships, lends towards privacy and community. And, you know, you feel it. When you walk onto a functioning co-housing, it's very palpable that, you know, what they put out there as child-friendly, senior-friendly, handicap-friendly, all the things that were their goals, they accomplished it because they were very hands-on. In fact, this one right here, one of the Nevada City co-housing goals was to facilitate a spontaneous lifestyle. Well, here, these three women on the right were going to the movies, and Victoria on the left is texting her husband saying, "I'm going to the movies, by the way." You know, Leal there to the right, sitting on her front porch, 81 years old now. You know, when we were planning this project, she moved from a, you know, very spread out world, and, you know, in yonder and your, and she couldn't stop telling me, "Chuck, you know, keep in mind, all I care about is privacy, 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 privacy." And I kept saying, "Leal, well, why are you moving to this co-housing?" "Well, I might get used to it." But anyway, 10 years now, you know, she has a very functioning front porch, as you can see, and she has a very private back porch, as you can see. In 10 years, I've never seen her in her back porch. I could tell if she was in her backyard, but I've never seen her back there. And yet she is on the front porch every morning as people are going to school, going to work. She's, you know, as they're coming home from school, coming home from work, Leal is right there to say hello to people as they come by. It's just an incessant parade. And she doesn't have to sit there, but she enjoys it quite a bit. And when we first did our first book about co-housing in Europe, where it was started in Denmark in 1972, The stats showed that about 80% of the time that people were on the front porch or the rear of their house, they were on their front porch, which is the complete inverse of typical housing arrangements where you're 80% in your backyard, 20% in your front yard. That's what happens. You know, that's just what happens basically when people know you, and you want to say howdy. You want to see what's going on. Life between the buildings is real. You know, the outdoors is basically another room in our co-housing community. The front porch is real, the most important, you know, room in the house in some ways, and especially in connecting you to the neighborhood. You know, there's you know, it's too bad that the front porch ever atrophied. I mean, I know that the context is quite different from San Francisco. San Francisco is unique, but it's interesting. You know, we just finished a very urban project in middle of downtown Santa Cruz. We have one under construction, you know, very dense Vancouver, just finishing one in Mountain View. And the concepts are extremely similar, basically, where it's have a semi-private or a semi-public, however you want to define it, front porch and a very private backyard. But in any case, the front porch has got a real life, whether you just stop. If you're in your front porch, you're fair game. You know, somebody's reading the paper and got a cup of coffee, you kind of, coffee looks pretty good. And they like to stop and make fun of you while you're playing, you know, cards and what have you. Your backyard porch, you feel like you have as much privacy as you ever wanted. As Meg here on the right is 95 years old in her backyard, and she's got another friend over that also lives in the co-housing in her backyard, and they feel like there's privacy, as much privacy as they want, unless, you know, I come by and say, "Hey, do you guys mind if I take a photo?" Interestingly enough, Meg, 95 on the right, she, her kids, when she moved in, convinced her that she should live right next to the parking lot because, you know, she's old and she might have to, you know, get out of the car and want to be very proximate to her house and right there and all the rest. And it's really one of the interesting things is how much attention goes into the limitations of seniors unless you ask seniors themselves. Meg, who lived in that house for a couple of years and then moved to the absolutely farthest house, 700 feet from the parking lot. So one day I asked her, I said, Meg, why did you make that move? I mean, that was a big deal, 95 years old. And she says, well, you know, Chuck, it turns out that my relationship with my neighbors is much more important than my relationship with my car. Coming and going from her car, she runs into a lot of folks. As I mentioned, the common house is another key aspect. I'm always amazed in the course of planning a new project, folks who've never had a common house before, and now all of a sudden they've got to have, you know, not only common dining, common kitchen, you know, in this case, intergenerational kids room. You know, we just finished a couple senior co-housing, caretakers units, lots and lots of guest rooms for the kids and the grandkids and all the rest that are owned together, that are down the lane from the house, that makes each individual who lives there life more convenient, more practical, more economical, more interesting, more fun, because we own it together, not that I own my own. And by owning together, it's obviously more economical. By owning it together, it's actually more fun to manage and all the rest. But what always astounds me is how big these common houses are getting, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 square feet. The one in Vancouver is 6,500 square feet. In other words, as people have started to realize that if I make my own house, the best way to make my house more economical, for example, is to just jam more stuff in the common house. And, you know, then I can bring my own house down to the bare bones, for example. And I don't have to have a guest room for the occasional guest because I have a guest room in the common house and we all just share it, for example. But anyway, here in Bellingham, Washington, a 33-unit co-housing community, this particular group, again, it's about making the project very much, or in this case the common house, very much fit like a glove, not be some empty vessel that's, you know, looks good to the kids when they're looking for a place for mom to reside to. But this group was very adamant from the beginning. Chuck, we really like to dance. Dancing is important. We're all about dancing, 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 dancing. Long winter nights in Bellingham. It's up at the 49th parallel. And I said, okay, I know, I got it. You know, I mean, you only had to tell me once. I wrote it down. but they were adamant. And so I sprung the floor and made the lights able to move up. And sure enough, on May 12, 2000, their very first common dinner in the common house, right after dinner, they moved the tables out of the way and started dancing. So I thought, that's kind of interesting. I wonder how long that's going to last. Well, next day, they moved the tables out of the way and started dancing. So they were serious about it. And it's really interesting. It's a very anthropological kind of job I feel like I have, is getting in there and trying to figure out the needs, wants, and desires of this culture and responding to the needs, wants, and desires of this real culture, not just market default, you know, devices that are based on the rearview mirror. These groups don't put out there who they are very much as they put out who they want to be, who they aspire to be, who they aspire to become, what, you know, what they aspire to effect they hope to have on the planet. Living light on the earth is always a value that percolates to the top, and yet it's extremely complicated sometimes as an individual to implement that goal, but it's a lot easier with a lot of other folks. I know that because where I live, none of the 34 households had solar panels before. Last year, my electric bill was -$88 for the year, and that's because I have 1 kilowatt of electric. Everybody has 1 kilowatt of electric. I think the average in our co-housing is about -$50. None of those people had solar panels before. We all have 100% sustainably grown lumber. In other words, no clear-cut forests. Well, who knows what goes into most houses, but we know that ours is not clear-cut. That costs us about $2,000 a house to do it that way, but that was a value that percolated up to the top, and we just decided by consensus to accomplish that. And you can just read that across the board. Every decision is about reaching our potential, bringing the wisdom of all the people. It might be this number of people right here to the table and figuring out what's the smartest thing to do, as opposed to what you can dream up, whether you've looked it up on the net or not. You know, you find that a lot of wisdom percolates to the top, and you're all acting at your best behalf because you have a collective wisdom that's much, much better than you're able to generate yourself. You know, as an architect, I really care a lot about, you know, light and airy and warm and cozy environments. But the mantra in our office is, if it doesn't work socially, why bother? This is the common house where I live. We have dinner available there 6 nights a week. But if it doesn't work socially, why bother? And, you know, I've come to the conclusion that our second highest priority as a species is to try to figure out how to get along. Theoretically, our first highest priority is to go forth and replenish the earth, like every species' first priority. But at 7.5 billion, I think we pretty much accomplished that. So now we just have to figure out how to make sense. Well, community is important, and it's a highly touted word, and it's nebulous, but it's theoretically in our back of our mind. It's something that we should be doing. And I have never seen or found anything that better facilitates the concept of growing a community like breaking bread together. I mean, it's timeless. We've been, you know, high-functioning communities have been doing it for a very long time. And it's a practical reason to get together, especially for Americans where we don't have a lot of ritual in our lives anymore. Luckily, we have to still eat, so we have an excuse to get together. What happens at common dinner is, sure, this is a great dinner, and I'm so glad somebody made it, and I'll make dinner tomorrow, etc. But, hey, I'm going cross-country skiing this weekend. You want to go? Hey, I'm taking the kids to the zoo this Saturday. You want me to take your kids? Hey, I hear Margaret's not having a good time right now. Maybe we should go check on her after dinner. That kind of interstitial activity is the quiet glue that you know, makes a functioning society, and it starts with having practical reasons to get together. Like 10 o'clock coffee. They do it at this co-housing community every day. Managing it together is real. It's probably the number one thing that scares people away from co-housing. I wish they could watch, you know, one of our common meetings, because what you'll see is once you've learned to work together, it's not the big deal that you would think it is. It's getting over that hump. We have a very hierarchical society. You either give orders or take orders. And the idea of sitting around with this number of people and saying, well, do we cut the tree down or do we don't cut the tree down? Scares a lot of people. And I grew up in a very hierarchical world, so it would have scared me too if I hadn't just seen it operate and you know, again, over and over and over again, watch a group make a decision better than any individual does. We cut the tree down, but we didn't just leave it lie there and rot. Somebody else suggested, hey, Chuck, maybe we don't cut the tree down at 7:30. Maybe we cut it down at 8:30. Maybe we get it to all the wood, to firewood, to an Iraqi veteran who just come home and couldn't get his firewood in, and instead of letting it rot like we did last time. So in other words, over and over and over again, I see the group making decisions better than I would have myself. In fact, people sometimes ask me, what's the worst part about living in co-housing? And I have to say, especially for all the white guys, the worst part is they come into the room every time they're sure they know what the answer is. And then they realize that they didn't. And they just get annoyed. I thought for sure I had the answer. But accepting the better answer when it percolates to the top is where the growth is. And over and over and over again, what I hear about the best part about living in co-housing is how the individuals grow as individuals, not only as a group, but as individuals, about how to get the best out of whoever they're working with, you know, at work or school or elsewhere. Whoops. Common dinner. And the kinds of activities that emanate. You know, the common house is just has to be reintroduced, really, because we don't have these kind of neutral environments anymore. We, you know, again, when you don't know people, you just want to get into the store and get out of the store. You don't stop and say, hey, do you want to play checkers? Much. You don't say that much anymore. Co-housing, as accomplished to date in the U.S., about 120 projects, is mostly very child-rearing oriented. And, you know, we raised our child in co-housing. It's made her a super, you know, capable person, I believe. And you know, just most people get involved because of the kids, which means you're having kids, chasing kids, being chased by kids. That's the common scenario there. And it makes sense. You know, in 2004, we won the This project, 50 miles north of north of San Francisco, Cotati, California, it won Best Neighborhood in the U.S. by the National Association of Home Builders. That was a year that they built about 1.6 million houses in the U.S., and this little 30-unit co-housing community got the Best Neighborhood in the U.S. And, you know, it makes sense. If you look at this slide, you think about those parents who spent this quality of time, you know, real quality of time, crafting a neighborhood that really made sense to their child-rearing goals, it completely made sense. Interestingly enough, there's a lot of interesting things about this project, but this project took 3 years to implement, start to finish. The three brand-new projects around us took 5 years, 5 years, and 7 years. So sometimes people think, oh, this, you know, sitting around and making decisions, doesn't that slow you down? It is the opposite of the cowboy mentality, for sure. And yet it doesn't seem to slow us down. It actually makes these projects happen a lot faster because, you know, everybody sees, you know, the city sees, for example, their job is to not be, you know, the editor. It's not to be the critiquer because, you know, we get these moms up to the podium and say, no, this is what we wanted to do. No, this is what we wanted to do. No, this is it. This is kind of what we want to do. And the city kind of goes, well, okay. And because the city doesn't feel anymore that their job is to be the watchdog over the big bad developer. These guys are the big bad developer. So they turn out to not be that bad. They have a very lively environment there. Kids, you know, a place for parents to be parents and kids to be kids is a very common device like that, or a goal like that privacy and community goal. And, you know, the guys sit around in the workshop and after dinner and talk about stuff. I never see them do anything. That's the interesting thing. You know, they sometimes look at catalogs. I think they these off-cut wood pieces, they bought that barrel. But the kids own the joint. That's the main point when it comes to intergenerational co-housing. They really do own the joint, and you feel it, which sometimes works for the older seniors and sometimes doesn't. And so, you know, enter senior co-housing. And why did that come to fruition? Well, it's really obvious to me because, you know, we have 37 kids, and sometimes the 10-year-olds will get really loud and rambunctious at the swimming pool, for example, and you'll see three seniors moseying over there to see what all the ruckus is about, and three seniors getting out of there as fast as possible. And so there is a separate, you know, state of mind, I guess, for tolerance with 2-year-olds and 5-year-olds, especially at dinner. And they pretty much hang out with each other. I had dinner with them a couple nights ago, and it was really interesting to me. They were talking about, they decided to figure out right there while they were sitting there, who's the best knee doctor of the four in town. And I knew these poor knee doctors, they didn't have a chance. They had them totally triangulated in about 5 minutes, and it was dead clear to everybody who was the best knee doctor after just a little bit of conversation. And they do a lot of, you know, outside stuff together. They are, you know, sort of a sub-community in the community, if you will. Enter, you know, senior co-housing. I have to say, you know, visiting senior co-housing in the U.S., and when I wrote my book about senior co-housing in Denmark, that I've never seen anybody have as much fun since the college dorms. Frankly. I mean, it was very similar, I thought. You know, look, they don't have jobs. They don't have kids. You know, they're not chasing the career yet or anymore. They're just having a good time. Of course, I was showing this slide recently, and somebody said, Chuck, yeah, well, sure, there's 9 people and 11 bottles of wine. I mean, just do the math. You know, the math's not that complicated. So, and every time I visited one, I was pretty astounded. Now, that slide right there is 12 years ago. That is 2 months ago at a senior co-housing in Grass Valley, California. That's 12 months ago, and that's 12 years ago in Denmark. That's 12 years ago in Denmark. That's 2 months ago in Grass Valley, California. This idea of, you know, being centripetal, and chatting about the issues of the day is timeless. I mean, this I could show you a bazillion slides like this, which makes sense in the course of natural human habitation, basically, as opposed to sitting at home watching TV. Interestingly enough, I went for a hike with these guys a couple weeks ago, Katie and I did, very rough terrain, you know, up by Tahoe, and, you know, lots of rocks, and of course somebody twisted their ankle, and now they're recovering. So, I mean, that's their recovery. That's what the recovery looks like in senior co-housing. I've decided, you know, okay, who's got the wine? I'm going to sit here with my ankle in ice, and what are we going to do? I mean, one of the guys here just had a heart episode. they've been living there for about 2 years. Had a heart episode, was at the hospital for a couple weeks, and was getting ready to come home, and the doctor came up to him with his clipboard and said, well, Mike, anybody at home to take care of you, to look out after you? And Mike said, yeah, about 30 people. And he was very happy about that. My favorite quote these days is I had dinner there a couple weeks ago, and one of the residents was sitting there and said, Chuck, you know, I should just tell you that before I moved here, I was buying about 5 or 6 tanks of gas a month, and now I'm buying less than 1 tank of gas a month. And the woman next to him says, yeah, since I've lived here, I've gotten rid of my car altogether. So, you know, that makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, it's obvious that could happen here. In 2001, Katie and I got the Human Habitat Award from the United Nations. And when they called me from London to say, hey, you guys got the Human Habitat Award, I thought to myself, oh, I actually said to the woman, there's no way. I thought this was a prank or something. I said, there's no way. You've never given it to an American. Why are you giving it to an American now? It's usually somebody in the Philippines or South Africa or something. And she says, well, you know, this year, 2001, we decided that the Americans are the locus on the planet and you guys are trying to do something about it. So, interesting. And I remembered, when she mentioned that, I had remembered that was her criteria that year. We were using it more than our share. I mean, there's no mystery about that. The only mystery is, what are we going to do about it? What are we going to do about not only amping down our consumption, but amping up our quality of life? It's not actually nuclear science. It's only a question of how we're going to do it. Well, the answer is each other. You know, I don't know, does anybody here know the shortest poem in the English language? No, it's not anymore. Me, we. Me, we. The author was Muhammad Ali. He was, you go to Bartlett Book of Quotes, it's the shortest poem in the English language, me, we. And in 1975, he was asked to be the commencement speaker at Harvard. And as he was leaving the podium, the crowd chanted, Ali, give us a poem. So he comes back to the podium and he says, me, we. And of course, you know, the shortest poem in the English language, you think it gets a lot of interpretation. And the interpretation, the prevailing interpretation, is that I can't be me until we are we. And I don't think that's any mystery to anybody. The only mystery are the mechanisms by which we're going to accomplish that. I actually came across co-housing in 1980. I quote-unquote discovered co-housing in 1980 when I was going to the University of Copenhagen. And it wasn't through school or anything like that. It was on my 20-minute walk to the train station every morning. I would walk by these single-family houses, and there was nobody stopping and chatting with each other, no life between the buildings. You know, apartment buildings, no life between the buildings. Condos, no life between the buildings. Assisted care, no life between the buildings. I mean, it was a very rich walk. It was actually in the suburbs of Copenhagen. And now, yet there was this one project that every single time it seemed like I walked by that, there were people between the buildings, talking with each other, having a cup of tea together, picking apples, you know, working with the kids, working on a picnic table, working under a car or whatever, just, you know, sort of manage the ranch together. And so finally one day I just stopped and went, you know, asked this woman in my broken Danish, what's going on here? And this woman answered to me in her perfect English, well, you know, her husband and her had actually lived in good neighborhoods, functioning neighborhoods when they were kids, not affluent neighborhoods, just functioning neighborhoods. And they, in fact, wanted their kids to live in functioning neighborhoods. And, it, you know, if you don't actually create it yourself, it's a little bit of a crapshoot. You don't know what you're going to get. You may or may not get that. And you're not going to, you know, the average American moves every 7 years. I don't know what they're looking for exactly, but I guess it's a functioning neighborhood. I'm not sure. But so, in fact, she says, we created it ourselves. We just decided to roll up our sleeves and make our own neighborhood. And at that moment, I thought to myself, wow, this is an extremely conservative notion. It's so conservative that, you know, I'm just not taking any chances. I'm actually going to, you know, there's an old saying that, you know, if you want to see the future you want to see, you have to create it. Well, she was, in fact, creating it, and her family were creating it. Now, interesting thing about this project is this is a senior co-housing project. And I, like every other visitor, was kind of astounded that half of the units were upstairs. And so I, like everybody else, says, what's up with that? This is seniors. And they said, well, you know, they laughed about it at first. You know, they were made light of it. You know, it keeps us young or whatever, you know, what people say. But later, over a bottle of wine, got to the bottom line, and they said, you know, we've been messing around for 5 years, and we're not able to afford the new neighborhood that we had envisioned. So we decided to invite our architect and our builder to the meeting one night, and they said, okay, here's the deal. You're going to have half the units above the other units, and you're going to be upstairs. Half of them are going to be upstairs. And that works 100% fine. It's completely antithetical to what all the experts would think. It works absolutely 100% fine because they have an agreement that if you break an ankle or break a hip or whatever, you can move into these luxury digs in the common house, this caregiver suite if you wanted, or the guest room. If that doesn't work long term or even short term, but mostly long term, somebody downstairs will switch houses with you. So, you know, it's amazing how cooperation really does become the watershed. I mean, we always think that the architecture is, or money, is the watershed. You know, if we can just buy whatever we need, that must be the watershed. It turns out, I think, that cooperation is a bigger watershed in terms of getting individuals what they need. Interestingly enough, you know, those upper units were actually more expensive. They actually had a premium to them. You know, most of these seniors wanted to live upstairs. 14 years now later, nobody has actually moved downstairs. So, you know, we put together all these worst-case scenarios for seniors all the time. And yet, if you ask seniors what they want, well, this bocce ball with their friends is actually what they wanted. That activity, the verbs, not the nouns, not the thing, but the activities were what made the biggest difference in their quality of life. And yet, you know, it's the antithesis of, you know, those who die with the most toys win, for example. It's about, you know, having somebody to have a cup of tea with when you feel like it, etc. These guys, you know, the Danes, they have an ongoing seminar called Aging Successfully that feeds most people into senior co-housing because, again, you know, it always, you know, any book you read about aging successfully, you know, the Blue Zones or you name it, any book on the topic, they always boil down to the exact same three things. You know, eat right, mostly light, stay active, i.e. low impact, stay connected, i.e. community. They always say the same exact three things. And so these guys were so out of denial. This was started by two couples in their early 50s, and the group is half people in their early 50s. When they moved in, they actually moved in with five teenagers in the senior co-housing community. I mean, they were preparing themselves emotionally for being empty nesters, for example. I mean, for those of you who've been through that, you know that's a bit of a workout emotionally. And they were, you know, they were already thinking into the future. It seems to be the hardest part for Americans, where we are so inundated with youth and the beauty of youth, and I'm still young and I'm not a senior, and who's a senior? I'm not a senior. Nobody's a senior, basically. Nobody. You're not going to get very many people to admit they're a senior anyway. So for these guys to go, their mantra, the second half of my life is going to be as much fun as the first half. That was more or less their main design criteria. And by the way, that means, you know, taking matters into our own hands, not waiting around for somebody else. This is a Danish solution. You know, Sia says, again, as much privacy as I want and as much community as I want. I want to show this because I show so much stuff outside and in the common house. Interesting thing about studying senior co-housing after writing a book about intergenerational co-housing is this one is right next to intergenerational co-housing, and all of their intergenerational co-housings, farms are fallow, and the maintenance is wanton, and the seniors are just out there. You know, they had built this this thing to dry, you know, for their clothes to dry in, because these guys says, you know, look, I've been using a dryer my whole life. I'm tired of being a blight. I want to start to become a part of the solution. So, well, why not just dry it off? I mean, I'm retired. My shirt can take 2 days to dry. Who cares? They were building things all the time, like this greenhouse. I came to the conclusion that 5 people with time can do infinitely more than 50 people without time. And they were just active, active, active. Of course, they mostly did it so they could sit around and talk about it. And isn't that cool and stuff? And talk about their tomatoes. I've come to the conclusion that after 65, growing tomatoes is a competitive sport. It's just amazing how much time. We talked about the pedigree of those tomatoes. I mean, it's like, can we eat the tomatoes? Stillwater, Oklahoma, really an interesting project. You know, the only project I've worked on where over half of the co-housers were Republicans, for example. And yet I felt like I was swimming in love the whole time. It was a hoot, actually, as long as we didn't talk about politics. That was key. Very affordable. The woman on the far right there, she's the quintessential church lady. She was the administrator for a church. She, you know, made 65 years old, had only rented ever, and her and 6 other people needed houses for $150,000 or less. So it was a workout. But everybody rolled up their sleeves and worked really hard to make that happen. I know we did. We came up with these cool little cottages, and now they live there, and they've been living there for a couple of years, and it's quite great. And one of the women has gone on to get on the city council. You know, there's a lot of people who feel like once you've got together with 30, 40 people and came up with a consensus, you can, on, you know, the color of the table, you know, then you can do anything. Anyway, they have a great time there. These guys on the 2 on the left, they happen to be both physicians, but they often bring their instruments out. They had them on the front porch, and they asked them to bring them out, and, you know, that's life in co-housing. Grass Valley Senior Co-Housing, finished a couple years ago, a really special place. These guys all lived on ranches somewhere. To imagine moving into one building like that after living in a ranch somewhere, it was quite something. But, you know, it's interesting because, you know, Western Nevada County, 50,000 people total, and they made 64,000 trips with paratransit last year for seniors. 2,000 to 3,000 seniors, 64,000 trips. That's about 3 trips a senior per year. Some people, you know, these big lumbering buses about the size of this room that are taking 1 or 2 seniors, you know, across town to get groceries, to get prescription drugs, to visit a friend, et cetera, these housebound seniors. And some people argue, oh, my God, that's way so much for these big lumbering, spewing, you know, carbon dioxide, you know, just completely unsustainable things. And some people argue it's far too few. Well, these guys, they did just the opposite of that. Instead of waiting for somebody to come along and schlep them from one end of the town to the others to get groceries, they decided we're going to build a project right downtown where we can grow older sustainably and have more fun while we're doing it. And they basically all moved from Acreage. So that's interesting that what happens when you get together with other folks and you realize, you know, you get to know, it has to do with knowing these people, basically, and feeling comfortable with these people that make this kind of thing possible, I think. And, yeah, nice little houses. Little house. They have dinner 5 nights a week. Very successful. Mountain View, California. This one was complicated because we're surrounded on 3 sides by Google, LinkedIn, and Facebook. So, the city thought everybody had nothing but money. Let me put it that way. But again, it was a great co-design experience, and we took a single-family house lot. This one house is sitting right there on 0.9 acres. We moved moved that house out of the way and put on 19 other units, and it's got state-of-the-art caregiver units, state-of-the-art common house at every level. They're just about ready to move in. They haven't moved in yet, about a month away. Santa Cruz, I mentioned, downtown Santa Cruz, 0.24 acres, very small site, with 19 units. And they just moved in about a month ago. No art on the wall yet. Very dense project, and yet, and this thing, you know, as a Rubik's Cube, you would think that you would think there was not a lot of options. It's amazing how this group, you know, morphed that. Now, you're making me think that I better hustle. So let me just hustle. Boulder, Colorado. You know, the site plan, the group said, make sure everybody can see the bike shed so that we can all go biking every morning. There's 3 to 7 people there every morning at 10 o'clock. You know, Nevada City Co-Housing, this happens to be my house, and that happens to be my electric bill. That's my favorite slide, by the way. Fresno Co-Housing, for those who like the Mom Pal Kettle solution. Bill McKibben, who wrote the last... the forward to our last book, Creating Co-Housing. And, you know, he's the guy when it comes to global warming, as far as I'm concerned. And we asked him, called him up, said, hey, Bill, would you write the forward to our book? And I figured he'd say no. And he says, you know, I'd love to. And he wrote, and he told me at the point, he says, you know, Chuck, what I like about visiting co-housing more than anything else, it's not about, you know, all the energy conserving measures and all the rest that you guys take into consideration. It's the energy generation. Everywhere I go, I see people creating things and generating options and solutions and accommodating, you know, a functioning society. It looks like a functioning society. So I got to get behind that. Anyway, our myth, you know, it's real no matter how small. The castle, we got to have one. That's the biggest challenge. When people ask us what's the biggest challenge, is it the zoning department, is the banks? No, it's the myth that we live by. You know, the pick yourself up by the bootstraps kind of stuff. You know, I've still never seen anybody do that. But I hear it's done in America. And we built, I mentioned, you know, a lot of houses, but they more and more look like this. I was showing this slide in Germany a couple years ago, and some guy says, where's the front door? And I says, well, you know, you don't have to have one. It's, you know, you can just genie up your garage door, put your dinner in the microwave, and put your movie in the VCR, and you're living. That's a life. That's a lifestyle. You know, this whole notion of community, it's such a nebulous term. What does it mean? And it's something that we talk about, aspire to at some level, but it's so nebulous. Well, Christian there on the right, he's a quadriplegic that moved into Davis Co-Housing. And because he's a quadriplegic, he was a party to this 100-kid study nationwide. And of the 100 kids, quadriplegics, there was only 2 of them that had more interaction with people that were not paid to be with him than paid to be with him. The other 98 had more interaction with people that were paid to be with them, the therapists and the physical therapists and the optometrist and the wheelchair, you know, tweaker, and just goes on and on. The other one lived in a co-op in Manhattan. But when he moved into this co-housing, before that he had about 3 hours of peer interaction a week, and it was very strange. His mother getting the electric wheelchair in the car, taking him over to one other friend's, trying to play Nintendo even though he couldn't use his hands. It was all weird. Here, you don't need the study to tell you that when you walk onto this site and whatever the kids are doing, Christian is simply included. There's no mystery about it. It's just what happens. Now, the interesting thing about this project is that developer who did the co-housing community with us is the same developer who did this project. Same exact developer. The difference is when she did this project, she just didn't have any choice but to look to the rearview mirror. What sold last time? Here, we talked to the parents. We worked with the parents very carefully and some exercises with the kid and made a neighborhood that felt like a neighborhood. Emeryville Co-Housing, where Fran lives. You know, I love this slide because, again, the challenge is our culture, I feel, more than anything else. I love this slide because, as I recall, on this particular slide, nobody in that slide is born in the USA, including my wife, Katie, on the right, who was born in Japan. And, you know, when I did a project in downtown Tokyo a few years ago, 19 of the 25 people who started that project were from a village. in downtown Tokyo. Tokyo is 25 million people, but there's these muras outside in Japan that have 100 to 200 people. So something happens. You know, we've lost touch with the concept, really, of community over the last few generations. And it was these people who had known what a community meant, that they wanted to live in a community-like setting in Tokyo because they were actually, you know, just felt cast adrift, anonymous in that very crowded city. And I sometimes I wonder, you know, how much, you know, and how often actually across the board, there's always a few people in each community who've lived in very high-functioning small towns or high-functioning neighborhoods that have had historically known the benefit. Otherwise, we're the benefit, our quality of life is through electronic gadgets, bigger and better TVs, faster and smaller cars, you name it. And we don't necessarily see that there's this social component that is like, you know, is like a benefit. Emeryville, I just happened to be in San Francisco, so I thought I'd show a few of these slides. My grandmother in the middle there, in the small town I grew up in. You know, she was bedridden her last 10 years entirely, and 15 different people in that town made all the difference. Well, they basically took care of her, basically. That's what happens in a village, basically. If you need to know more, well, there's some books here to pick up. Thank you, guys.
We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Senior Co-Housing with author and architect Charles Durrett. Our thanks to him, and we're ready for your comments now. I'll be moderating today's audience questions, and we have till about 6:30 for that.
Yeah, thank you very much. Wonderful presentation. Really enjoyed it. Just asking for a couple of comments. First, it's nice to get input from the people who are going to live there, but people will die, especially in senior co-housing. Could you comment on the transfer of units? I looked into buying a unit at one point. And the other question is, I just put my mother into independent living facility, which seemed to have a lot of the good qualities of senior co-housing.
Number one, the transfer of units. Yeah, people move. And you know, it's funny because the a house in Sacramento co-housing just moved recently. Actually, first one was after 14 years, 25 houses. And the average American moves every 7 years, so they moved 14 in 25 years. So that was 1/50th. Of the neighborhood as the American average. That's not true everywhere. You know, in Emeryville, we had quite a, you know, people getting careers and dying, as you suggested. And it happens. You know, I basically believe, Katie and I basically believe, there's no way you can sort of vet, you know, the perfect co-housers. And so we don't try. For those of you who remember the, you know, in college where people said, oh, you know, I love to wash dishes. You know, people will say anything, right? So the goal is to get them to come to the co-housing, come to a couple of common dinners, come to a couple work days, come to a couple common meetings, and figure out if this community is for you. Most of the people, like where I live, they've been waiting in the wings for some time and actually had been coming to work days and such like that previously and wanted to participate. You know, one of my favorite stories I tell about Fran here is that, you know, we had a visitor once there in Emeryville, who didn't think they wanted to cook dinner for everybody. I like this whole co-housing, and I don't think I could cook dinner for everybody, and you can't make me, and blah, blah, blah. And Fran sort of showed the poor guy, the poor programming dude, the door and says, you know, there's a whole world out there for people who don't cook dinner for each other, so here we cook dinner for each other. I don't know if I got that right, Fran, or not. You can tell me afterwards, more or less. Anyway, you know, like a small town, you know, people, you know, play a role in keeping up the functioning community. As far as the independent care, you know, that's great. There's a wide variety of possibilities. I'm waiting with bated breath for senior care to get a lot more humane. Personally, my mother lived in the absolutely best assisted care I could find for her in Sacramento. She hated it with a passion. You know, she was there for a number of years, and within the very first week, they tried to kick her out because my sister had left some Tylenol there, her favorite way to stave off a headache. You know, it was an absolutely zero tolerance, around meds in your room. You know, you have to have this 17-year-old come to the room and administrate, meds to you. She hated that whole scene. And, just remarkable to me, this woman who had her own business, ultra-responsible, had raised 6 kids, et cetera, now all of a sudden she's being treated like a child again and not independent at all. So anyway, yeah.
Did you have a question?
I'm sorry.
I was kind of curious about the economics of it. I assume it's very much like a co-op where you buy into your unit. Are there any co-housing where people who maybe don't have that kind of income can rent in co-housing? Is there such an option, or is that something nobody's actually
addressed? No, there is. We have 5 people in our co-housing of 34 units who rent a house. And then we have, I think it's 5 or 6 people who rent a room in a house. You know, so a number of seniors there, they have 2 or 3-bedroom houses and they rent out a room to the house, and that's actually very common, too.
Oh, okay.
And that's certainly the most affordable way. We have 3 single moms who live in our co-housing. 2 of them rent a room from a senior, actually, or a couple rooms from a senior. So, yeah, someday I'm hoping that there'll be some projects that are all rentals. We'll see how that goes. They certainly are very common in Europe, for example. But we need some nonprofits or some developers who want to own the whole thing and rent it, for example. We've talked to nonprofits forever. You know, we have such dire issues in this country around homelessness. You know, according to Amnesty International, we have 2.3 million homeless people in this country, consequential. So I think theoretically we would make that better before we started, you know, making affordable co-housing, I think. Too bad. It's our approach, you know, as a culture, we sort of let people, you know, fall out of the boat before we take care of them. You know, what makes the Danish system work so much better is there's a serious assistance to people in the middle class trying to help them stay in the middle class, but we haven't gotten that piece figured out yet. So we have dire needs. Sir.
Hi there. I'm wondering if you could comment on urban co-housing and the challenges thereof. So I'm working on what I would claim to be the first co-housing community in San Francisco. We have 3 buildings under long-term lease in SoMa. And have we been following adaptive reuse and that kind of piecemeal approach of gathering things?
No, that's a good question. Whatever happens in San Francisco is going to probably have to be pretty darn creative, for sure. And yet I think it's infinitely doable. I mean, I hear people say all the time, oh, no, there's no land left, et cetera. Except every time I turn around, there's another 1,000 units built every year in town. In fact, recently I think I read there's 2,000 built last year. So there's plenty of things happening. There is a cash flow issue, which makes San Francisco the most challenging. I mean, most pieces of land that groups buy, they buy, if it's a $1 million site, they can pay, $5,000, $10,000, every couple of months, and then until the construction happens a year later or 2 years later, then they buy the rest of the property. Well, in San Francisco, our experience was, this site is $5 million, and I need it in 30 days. You know, so those make it pretty challenging for co-housing communities. But I think that there's, your organic approach might be key, and I think there's a lot of other ways that it can. You know, the one thing I still hasn't happened in the U.S., it happens, very much in Denmark and the rest of Europe, is where a co-housing group will buy a whole floor in a new apartment building, for example, or a new condo building. They'll just buy the whole floor and get a couple units turned into the common house, for example. So we got to start getting broader and more creative.
Hi, Chuck. So in San Francisco, most likely a property for 30 to 40 units, that seems to be a sweet spot for a number of units. So going vertical. So in these vertical buildings, 30 to 40 units, what common area do you recommend as like a must-have, and then it would be great to have, and also address how healthcare issues can be dealt with for senior-only housing?
Okay. As far as the number goes, you'll find in both of our books, we dwell on the numbers. It's really 25 to 35 houses. In fact, we're actually, you know, the Danes stopped. They were very clear from the beginning, you know, no more than 50 adults. That's the that's their key number. And it turns out that whether it's 25 or 30, that's, and they give like 8 reasons, and they're great reasons. They really panned out empirically from a management and everything else. As far as what the common facilities are, you know, I try to never go to a co-housing community with a lot of predisposition about what I think that should be. I mean, of course, I feel strongly about the common dining. But the cool thing is that every single group we work with, that always percolates up right up to the front, especially when, you know, if you just look at making life more convenient, more practical, more economical. I'll tell you, having somebody else shop, cook, and clean up is the beginning of that reality, basically, and that's the beginning of community too. I mean, it's just a win-win-win-win-win solution. But anyway, you know, I find every group gets really good at getting clear about, you know, whether they need a workshop or a bike workshop or whatever. I've worked on a couple of co-living arrangements in San Francisco. The workshops seem to be very popular in San Francisco, you know, because it's really hard to get your garage, for example. So if we can have, I mean, some of the workshops are this size, you know, for 20, 30 households. And it's kind of amazing that, you know, that, you know, these people see this as so key. But, you know, again, making life easier. Well, right, you know, you move in, you break the chair, you got to fix the chair, right? And I'm tired of getting the pliers out in my dining table and living room and, you know, just find a workshop where you get the pipe clamps and, you know, got the right glue and got the radio and got 2 or 3 other people working on something. It makes it a whole nother experience. So,
Chuck, unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where we have opportunity for one last question, and then hopefully you can stay after. And certainly I noticed that there are many of the common questions answered in your book, so I want to encourage people. They're for sale outside of the room. You're more than welcome to purchase one, get questions answered that way as well, and I'd like to end with your question.
Yeah, I was part of that group that set up the Emeryville one, and I'm glad it worked out. My life didn't work out that way, but it might in the future, but it would be in Palo Alto. How's chances in Palo Alto? Because it's expensive there.
There's been several forming groups in Palo Alto. The challenge always seems to be getting a site. I mean, there's a couple of realtors in the room tonight. I tell you, they should become your great friends, but even realtors have had a hard time, in my experience, sometimes, you know, getting the site needed that a co-housing group needs. I don't know why. I think that when some realtor talent percolates to the top, we'll find some great sites. You know, in Nevada City, where I live, you know, Katie and I did our first presentation there in 1989. Between 1989 and 2002, 13 years, 6 groups had come and gone. Come and gone, just like Palo Alto. Come and gone, come and gone. So finally, I got really impatient because I wanted to move to Nevada City. So I went up there, and within a week, got a purchase, you know, got an agreement for an 11-acre site. And people came. We had 150 people showed up at our first public presentation there, on our second public presentation, 2002, August 22nd. And everybody came up to me afterwards and said, Chuck, how did you find the site? And I said, I know. You know, it's 11 acres right on Main Street, right downtown. But it was hidden by this 4x8 sheet piece of plywood that said for sale. So in other words, and you know, there's just a leap. You know, there's just this weird leap of, you know, getting together with a couple of people and saying, let's do this. So that's what it's going to take in Palo Alto and anywhere. There is one unit left in Mountain View, by the way, just up the street. I know it's not Palo Alto. I know how people Palo Alto feel, But it's lovely. It's right downtown. You know, again, these people are completely car-bound previously, and they're right downtown. You can walk to Castro Street. It's super. So consider that one. Yeah. Oh, and by the way, I also want to mention that Fair Oaks, California, has a phenomenal site. You know, right outside of Sacramento, they have an unbelievable site. They're making a Fair Oaks eco-housing, as they're describing it. And it's a little paradise, frankly, and they actually have a whole bunch of houses. They're about ready to start construction soon, so they have a whole bunch of houses still available. So I know it's not Palo Alto, but it's a great place.
Thank you so much. Our thanks to Charles Durrett, author and architect. He wrote the Senior Co-Housing Handbook. We also thank our audience here as well as those listening to the recording. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 111th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.